Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Christopher Schmidt about his study of the sit-in protests that challenged Jim Crow in the South in 1960, entitled The Sit-Ins, Protest and Legal Change in the Civil Rights Era. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Yeah, I am a professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law, where I teach constitutional law and legal history, and I'm also an associate dean here at Chicago Kent. And I also have a joint appointment with the American Bar Foundation, which is a nonprofit legal research institute. And at the Bar Foundation, I also serve as the editor of our peer-reviewed journal, Law and Social Inquiry.
So you wear quite a few hats.
I keep busy.
What was it that led you to write this book?
This book actually began as my third year law school seminar paper. So I started off training. I thought I was going to be a history professor. I went and earned a PhD in American Studies from Harvard. And during my process of getting the PhD and doing my dissertation, I became more and more interested in legal history, and then eventually decided I wanted to go to law school after I completed the PhD. So I went directly from completing the PhD into law school. And then during law school, I was looking around for some new topics to work on. And during my third year seminar, I decided I wanted to write a study of the sit-ins. And specifically, I was intrigued by the sit-ins because in my constitutional law class, we studied a series of cases, which are known as the sit-in cases, which were basically appeals of criminal convictions deriving from students who had participated in the sit-in protests. And I was just fascinated by some of the legal issues that emerged in these protests. And I thought it'd be an interesting seminar paper to try and talk about how social protests influences the development of constitutional law, constitutional doctrine. And I decided to use this as a case study for that inquiry.
And from there, it develops into a very interesting book, which provides a very fascinating, describes this interaction between law and activism. And as you explain at the beginning of the book, it starts with the activism. I was wondering if you could set the scene for us by explaining the genesis of the protests and how they went from being this local action to being a region-wide movement that received national attention.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating story, and it's one of the iconic stories of the civil rights era. So it began in Greensboro, North Carolina. We have four first-year college students at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College. They're sitting in their dorm rooms talking about the experience of being young black men in the American South. This is late 1959. Eventually, it folds over into early 1960. And they're talking about their experiences, and they're trying to think about what they can do. And clearly, they're frustrated with the situation, but there also weren't a lot of models out there for exactly what young black college students could do in this situation. And they did some studying, they did some talking, and finally they decided that what they wanted to do was to go into a lunch counter in which the policy at most of these southern lunch counters were that African Americans could go into the stores, could buy items in the stores, could even go to the lunch counter and oftentimes buy food, but they weren't allowed to sit down at these lunch counters. So these four students decided they're going to go in there and they were going to take a seat at the lunch counter and ask to be served. And on February 1st, 1960, mid-afternoon, they walk into the Greensboro Woolworth store. They buy a few items in the store, then they sit down at a lunch counter, and they ask to be served. And they refuse. And they decide they're just going to stay there. And they stayed there through the afternoon until it closed in the late afternoon. And then they went back to school. And then they decided they wanted to do it again. And this time they talked to some of their friends and they got some more people to come. So the second day of the Greensboro protests, there are about 20 students there. And then they do it again the day after this. And they start bringing more and more people. And by the end of the week, it started on a Monday, by Friday, there are a couple hundred African-American college students from the Greensboro area who are coming in and participating in these sit-ins. They start having shifts. They start organizing themselves. And eventually this becomes a big story. It becomes a major story in the local press, of course, and then it starts getting picked up by the national press. And then what happens, which is really amazing, and in some ways these protests themselves are not unprecedented. African Americans had protested against segregation in this form by sitting down and refusing to leave. But what really was amazing about this protest is how it took off. So by the end of the week, you have hundreds of people in Greensboro. And then within just a week, it starts getting picked up in other cities in the upper South. So other North Carolina cities start to have their own sit-in protests. People hear what's going on, and they start doing the same thing. And then by the end of the month, we have protests that are going on in 30 different cities across the South and 7 different states. 2 months after that very first protest, it spread to 48 different cities across the South and 11 different states. And then by the end of the spring, people estimate that some 50,000 students had taken part in a sit-in protest by the end of that spring. And eventually hundreds of them would also be arrested for what they were doing.
Now, what you've described is an event that is familiar to millions of Americans. The images are iconic. The lunch counter itself today is a part of an exhibit in Washington, D.C. And yet, as you explained at the beginning of your book, we only know and we only really study part of the story, and that there is a much more complex dimension of it that we don't address. And it's one that you know reflects the degree to which the sit-ins also were a deviation from what was the focus of so much of the civil rights movement throughout most of the 1950s. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon the key arguments you're making in this book and how they fit within the scholarship of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So everything I just told you about the sit-ins, that's actually pretty well known. You pick up any book on the sit-in movement, and it's going to have a section about the student sit-in movement. And the Greensboro story has been told over and over again. And there's also some quite nice historical case studies of different communities, including there's a wonderful book on Greensboro. There's some quite good books on places like Nashville, which is another hotbed of the sit-in movement. So we know the story of the sit-ins, about how they took off in this particular way. But actually, we've never actually had a book written completely on the sit-ins, which I know back when I was in my third year of law school and I was doing research, I assumed I was actually going to find the books. I thought there were going to be more than one books that had been written on this topic. And then I was going to do my study about how social protest intersects with constitutional development. And what I found is, in fact, there is no books necessarily dedicated to this. So one of my goals in this is just to fill, you know, what's a gap in the historical literature. We need a book on the sit-ins. And one of my goals was to make an effort to provide the first comprehensive book on the sit-in movement. But then above that, above the fact of just that this is a story that's well known but hasn't actually been the focus of a single book, I do have an argument. And that argument is about the role of law. And basically, my argument is that we can't really understand why the sit-ins took place when they did and why they have unfolded as they did without appreciating the distinctive legal context that was behind the sit-ins. And then the second argument is that part of the story of the sit-ins is not just the sit-in protests themselves, but what happened because of the sit-ins. And much of my book is focused on a debate over the meaning of the Constitution that was very much sparked by the sit-ins. And basically, the central question is it constitutionally permissible to have racial segregation in the lunch counters, which are privately owned and operated but are open to the public? And that makes a rather difficult constitutional issue. So sort of two parts to my argument, both focusing on trying to introduce law to the story. One having to do with law helping to explain how this historical event took place and why it took place. And the other one is trying to trace this really fascinating constitutional debate that the sit-in sparked in the years following the sit-in movement. So that takes my story from this 1960 sit-ins up until the mid-1960s as these legal debates are playing out.
One of the things you emphasize in the early chapters is how in the late 1950s, the civil rights movement has a very legally focused strategy towards addressing Jim Crow. And this is something with which we're very familiar, Brown versus Board of Education, the Little Rock Seven, so forth. You have this legal cases that are proceeding through the court system that are attempting to strike down these legal challenges. One of the things that was very interesting was you make it clear how the students in many ways just disdain this entire legalistic approach, and they adopted one that was much more focused upon direct action. Why did they do that? What was it exactly that led them to think that their direct action approach was much more effective?
Yeah, so much of the sit-ins, to really appreciate why the students acted as they did, you have to sort of capture what they were trying to do and what they were focusing on and why they were so really a mix of deep frustration as well as deep optimism. And this is fascinating, just trying to resurrect the mindset of these students who are taking part in this incredible protest. It was this really powerful mix of frustration with what the situation in which they were living, as well as real hope that they could change it. And the frustration was twofold. The frustration was certainly targeted at the obvious problem that was around them, which was Jim Crow, segregation, racial discrimination, pervasive racism. So clearly that was their primary target. They were trying to change the world to make it a better place. But also a lot of the frustration, and this is what's really fascinating as I dug into the student's story, a lot of frustration was also aimed at older African Americans, and it was aimed at the kind of tactics that was prevalent within the African American activist community prior to the 1960 sit-ins, which was largely focused on formal legal change, specifically focused on trying to lobby legislatures to try and change laws. By 1960, the federal government, Congress had finally passed the first civil rights law. It wasn't much, but it was the first one that they had passed since Reconstruction. But also we see a lot of activism focused on litigation. And this, of course, is the primary work of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And this is an organization that led the litigation challenge that culminated in Brown versus Board of Education, the 1954 Supreme Court decision desegregating public schools across the country. So these students recognized that there was change going on around them, but they were frustrated with the pace of change, and they were frustrated with what they saw as the relatively limited results that they were actually seeing from some of these changes. And if you think about it, the Brown case really played a powerful role. And it didn't play a powerful role as I think sometimes we overly simplistically think, which is Brown happened in 1954, and somehow it inspired African Americans to then take to the streets, and somehow it sparked the civil rights movement. The story is actually a lot more complicated than that, because just look at the timing. 1954 is 6 years after, before the sit-in protests. You have the Montgomery bus boycotts, but the connection between Brown and the Montgomery boycotts was not just that African Americans were inspired to boycott buses because of Brown. What I see with the students in 1960 was that they were inspired by the NAACP and what they did with Brown, but they also saw it as a cautionary tale, and they saw it as something that they actually wanted to avoid. And that was because that they were all about the age, if you think back to, you know, these are in 1960, they're say 20 years old. That means when Brown came down, they were maybe in middle school, starting high school. They were old enough to understand what Brown meant. They were old enough to talk to their teachers and to develop some sort of hope that now that Brown came down, their lives would be different. But the vast majority of African Americans who took part in the student sit-in movement in 1960, they still went to fully segregated schools. They were growing up in the South, and the South was largely defiant against Brown versus the Board of Education. There's only minimal school desegregation taking place in the 5, 6, 7 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, and it really wouldn't take off until about the mid-1960s. So when they looked to the lawyers and the work that the lawyers had done, they admired what they did. I mean, how could you not admire Thurgood Marshall and the work that they were doing? But they also said that it hadn't really achieved much. And then one of their goals was to try and find an alternative to litigation. They said that's the civil rights approach is what the lawyers are doing. It's about litigation lobbying. We need to try something different because that hasn't really worked. And therefore, when you see them, the students, trying to create their identity as a distinct movement, a lot of what they tried to do was to frame themselves in juxtaposition or opposition even to what the lawyers were doing. So the lawyers and Brown, it did inspire them, but in this sort of really interesting way, in that it both raised their expectations, but then it increased their disappointment, and then it moved them to try and be creative in finding alternative ways to try and create social change.
There's something, as I was reading those sections of your book, that I thought was very prescient in terms of anticipating what was going to happen in the 1960s with the baby boom generation, the idea of youth-driven change, that they really seemed to embody that spirit long before you see it cropping up in the counterculture and the Vietnam protests and so forth.
I think that's right. I mean, it's actually interesting because if you read a lot of commentary among activists in the late 1950s, they're actually incredibly down on the younger generation. They're saying, you know, maybe they're going off to college, they're getting too comfortable, they're getting sort of co-opted by consumer culture. And a lot of them is, you know, sort of being nostalgic back for their youth during the 1930s, when it seemed like the younger generation was more engaged, more active. And there's a lot of lamenting about how the students didn't really seem to be engaged. And then all of a sudden, and it really did come quite quickly, you have the student student movement, and then of course you have the 60s following that, in which you have the younger generation leading all sorts of social protest change movements. But it the sit-ins really was, in many ways, the spark for that. It really awakened a lot of people. And certainly a lot of white Northern College students were inspired by the sit-ins. Some of them actually came down to join the sit-ins. There were some white sympathizers who took part in the sit-ins. And then you have actually a big outbreak of sympathy boycotts. So if you're going to college, say in New York City, there are Woolworth stores in New York City. Woolworth is a national chain. Now, those New York City Woolworths don't segregate, but you could go boycott that New York City Woolworths because you're protesting that the Woolworth Corporation allows their southern stores to choose to segregate. So there are ways in which all sorts of people around the country, particularly college-age people, could actually take part in one way or another in the protest movement. And then, of course, these sympathy boycotts and organizations, organization around the student sit-in movement in 1960, they would then inspire subsequent protests. Some of it involved in the civil rights movement, some of it in the free speech movement out in Berkeley, and all sorts of youth-oriented protests that really characterized the coming decade.
Reference to the attitude of older African Americans towards the youth in the 1950s is actually quite funny, considering what you write about in the book as to their initial reaction to the sit-ins, which, as you describe, was in many corners was far from enthusiastic. In fact, there was a lot of concern expressed that it was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, and there's concern from a couple different angles. Certainly a lot of the older generation of African Americans were just wary of this particular tactic. So there are a lot of parents of the students who participate in the sit-ins who were concerned about the safety of their children, and they're concerned about the costs it could have on the larger African American community. So there was some hesitancy, particularly in the very early stages of the sit-ins. But what is really fascinating to see is that a lot of these people came around, and they came around pretty quickly. And in fact, some of the really strong criticism the students had for, you know, the older generation, they say our parents didn't do enough and now we need to stand up and do something. It ended up being quite unfair, because ultimately the older generation of African Americans was integral to the success of the sit-ins, because as these protests took off and as they're shown to be largely peaceful, and there was certainly a response by the white segregationists to it, but overwhelmingly the people who took part in the sit-ins were not subject to physical violence, and most of them were actually not arrested. You do see the older community seeing something in this. And there are, again, there are all sorts of ways. This is one of the most important things about the sit-ins. There are so many ways in which people who were not actually sitting on those bar stools could get involved. So the older African-American community largely boycotted the stores that were targeted by the sit-ins. So therefore, there's a strong economic cost by segregating businesses. They also started raising money, and the money would become important when the students began to get arrested because it helped pay for their legal expenses and for bail expenses. So ultimately, you actually see the African-American community in most of these southern cities, they are coming around behind them. So that's part of the story. That's just the people in the local communities. Now, you also see some initial hesitancy toward their protests by the lawyers. Right, so by the NAACP, particularly the New York-based national NAACP, and particularly their the litigation branch, which is called the Legal Defense Fund, LDF, which is what Thurgood Marshall was running at the time. And they're skeptical toward the sit-ins, at least when they first happened. And they're skeptical pretty much for two basic reasons. And this connects back up to this critical role that law plays in this history. One reason is just they're skeptical about direct action protests as a form of social change. Most of these people are lawyers, and they believe that law, changing laws, is the most effective way to have lasting change. And they are concerned that some of these protest activities, they get a lot of attention, they make a lot of noise, but they don't quite change things in the long term. So Thurgood Marshall actually was, again, particularly early in the protest, was just skeptical about the tactics. But they were also skeptical, at least critical, of the particular target the students chose. So targeting these privately owned, privately operated, but open to the public accommodations like lunch counters, they were very powerful as a spectacle. They were very powerful as a target for social protests. Again, reporters could be there. The pictures are so powerful. And these are something, the discrimination in this area was a very, it really resonated with a lot of African-Americans who came to support the protest movement. But the lawyers actually had a different view on it. And the lawyers had a different view on it because they knew about the existing doctrine related to the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So this is a provision of the Constitution with which they won Brown versus Board of Education. This is a provision of the Constitution that would really be the main tool for advancing the cause of racial equality in the Civil Rights era. But the problem was is that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause had what's called a state action limitation, meaning if you look at the text of the 14th Amendment, if you look at how the court has applied the 14th Amendment, it generally only applies to state actors, or put in another way, it generally only applies to the government. So Brown versus Board of Education, this is not a problem because we're talking about public schools, and public schools are run by the government. They're clear state actors. So, of course, the Equal Protection Clause applies to public schools. The only question in Brown was whether segregation violated the 14th Amendment, and that's what the court ultimately concluded in Brown. But even if you accept that segregation is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, at least in 1960, it wasn't clear whether that particular interpretation of the 14th Amendment necessarily meant that privately owned, privately operated public accommodations were prevented from racial discrimination, that they couldn't segregate because of this idea that they're not necessarily state actors. They're private businesses. So Thurgood Marshall and his allies in the NAACP, his fellow lawyers, they were just skeptical about whether the students had actually found a target of protest with which they could create an effective legal defense to help out the students. And they, at this time in 1960, they just felt like there were so many other legal issues that from their perspective was more pressing. And most important in this regard was actually getting the implementation of Brown versus Board of Education, actually implementing that school desegregation decision. And they thought that they'd won Brown. It's just a matter of convincing the South through litigation, through counsel litigation, to abide by Brown. Here, they felt there's a whole new legal issue, a legal issue that they weren't quite certain that they could win on in court. And they thought the students were kind of barking up the wrong tree here. So they chose the wrong tactic, I think some of them thought. And they certainly thought that they probably chose the wrong target as a matter of law. So there's lawyers actually had a lot of skepticism early on in the protest.
You describe how that skepticism was shared by the students. We've already referenced this, but I was struck by how you described that to the point where even when you did have arrests of students at the lunch counters and they would then enter the legal system, how they would sometimes refuse legal advice of the NAACP. They would refuse bail. They would prefer to be in jail and serve out their time. And how the lawyers approached this as it just was beyond their imagining that this was the right way to go, and yet the students insisted upon it.
Yeah, so this is just a perfect example about how the lawyers and the students were fighting the same general fight. They were both fighting to try and break down Jim Crow. They both wanted to see desegregation of these lunch counters, but just such different perspectives about the best way to get there. Because for the lawyers, you know, they would always advise their clients, you know, if you can stay out of jail, stay out of jail. If you can pay bail and stay out of jail, then do that. Always appeal your cases. Well, and again, eventually the NAACP lawyers eventually came to a position where they felt like they could make a strong argument on behalf of the students. Initially, they were skeptical, but then they sat down. They had big conferences. So eventually, within about a month, month and a half of after the first protest, you have the NAACP lawyers squarely coming out saying, we're going to defend these students, and if need be, we're going to try and take us all the way to the Supreme Court. So they eventually find a way in which they can back them. But then at this point, exactly right, the students are finding these alternative tactics. because what the lawyers wanted was the lawyer said, okay, you can do your protests, you get arrested. We have our test case, multiple test cases. Now let us take over. You stay out of jail, you keep your noses clean, and then we'll take this and see how far we can get through the litigation system. The students were like, no, you just don't understand, right? The whole point is the protest. And then they found these opportunities that when they were arrested, and thousands of them were arrested on charges of disorderly conduct or trespassing, because generally there were no Jim Crow laws that applied to these lunch counters. At least the southern states were no longer trying to enforce them after Brown versus Board of Education basically held them unconstitutional. But then they decided that once they got arrested, they didn't just want to then hand off the issue to the lawyers, because that defeated the whole purpose of a student-led movement, of an alternative to litigation. They were trying to find ways in which they could amplify their protests. And one of the most powerful ways they could amplify their protests was to refuse to pay jail, to pay bail and to go to jail, or to serve a jail sentence after conviction, because this was a really powerful platform to help amplify the injustice of what was going on. And Martin Luther King Jr., who at this point was playing a role of a sort of informal advisor for some of the students, was encouraging them to do this, because this is part of his philosophy of how nonviolent protests can bring this issue to a head within the community. So yeah, they and the lawyers kept saying no, like, you know, let us take over here. This is our job, is to sort of take these appeals through. At one point, Thurgood Marshall was giving a speech to some of the students, and he said, you know, you've done your job, now let us do ours. And John Lewis, who then, you know, one of the leading sit-in protesters from the Nashville community, who would then go on to become a longtime member of Congress, in his memoirs, he had this wonderful line saying this, you know, the students looked at each other and said, you know, he just didn't quite get it. I mean, Thurgood Marshall didn't quite understand what they were trying to do. Now, it is worth noting that this is a divergence in terms of their perspectives on the protests. I do ultimately conclude that the lawyers and the students were able to come together in a kind of workable relationship. It wasn't, they didn't always see eye to eye, but eventually they could both do their thing, meaning that the NAACP lawyers, they got plenty of material with which to take their appeals, and they did eventually get these cases to the Supreme Court, and that's part of the later part of the book. But the students can then keep doing their protests, and if they chose to, they could go to jail. And so you had sort of a two-track protest movement in which two different groups with two different visions of the best pathway to social change could each do their own thing without necessarily stepping on each other's toes.
One of the, you just referenced something that is a very interesting point in your book, which is that by 1960, Southern authorities are no longer actively enforcing Jim Crow laws because there is an awareness that even though the laws are on the books, they're no longer really enforceable. And what that highlights is the degree to which so much of Jim Crow in 1960 exists because of inertia. And I thought that was best spelled out in your chapter where you're describing the opposition to the sit-ins. You detail the spectrum of actors involved from the business owners to police, local officials, right up to the state level and the white supremacist counter-protesters. And for so many of them, and this is what I thought was hilarious, everyone was just passively hoping that someone else would take care of it, that someone else would step in and enforce this law. You had law enforcement was hamstrung by the need to have something on which to act. You had business officials businessmen who just wanted the whole thing to go away. You had local officials who didn't want to have their communities highlighted in this fashion. There's this constant unwillingness to sort of take this head on by so many of these people who are basically the ones against whom the students are protesting.
Yeah. So I have to say, the chapter of the book that most surprised me at how interesting it got was this chapter I dedicated, as you said, it's a chapter called The Opponents. So I try to sort of get into the group that stood against the student sit-in movement. And the more I delved into this, it did become fascinating. And so the themes that emerged in this chapter are one, that the opponents were deeply divided. right? So you have these all different groups. And once you start breaking them apart, you actually realize that their interest did not necessarily align, and their ability to try and follow through in their opposition to the protest did not necessarily align. And then the other thing that comes in is one of the reasons that these divisions were so consequential in the sit-in movement, and ultimately one of my key arguments is that much of the success of the sit-ins had to do with the opposition being divided. But one of the reasons these divisions were so consequential was the law. Right. So the legal issues simply played out differently in the sit-ins than they did, for example, in opposition to school desegregation. And that had consequences for how the opponents were pulled apart or how they could try and mobilize against what the sit-ins, the protesters are doing. And a lot of this comes down to the, what that topic I was talking about before, which is the limits of the 14th Amendment and the state action doctrine. So what you have after Brown versus Board of Education, basically, southern states are no longer able to directly enforce segregation laws. So actually, although there are some laws that are still on the books, basically by 1960, southern states are not trying to enforce laws that say African Americans and whites cannot sit together. So therefore, the burden of maintaining Jim Crow segregation was largely moved, at least from direct policing of segregation through segregation laws, it was then shifted on the shoulders of private citizens, at least in the realm of the lunch counter sit-ins. So the people who ultimately had the decision about whether to segregate or not segregate by 1960 in the arena of public accommodations were the people who ran the public accommodations. So ultimately, the people who ran the lunch counters could decide, do I want to have a segregated lunch counter or do I want to have a non-segregated lunch counter? And at that time, there are basically no laws telling them they had to go one way or the other, right? So the segregation laws had been either repealed or no longer being enforced. Or, and on the other side, southern states had no public accommodation laws requiring non-discrimination like there were in many northern states. And eventually, there would eventually be a federal law that would come out of this debate. So they had a choice. Most of the southern business owners chose to segregate. But then you had the sit-in protests, and they start targeting them. And it's important that the protesters see one of their primary targets, not necessarily being, you know, courts or legislatures or Congress, but one of their targets were simply the owners of the lunch counters or the operators of lunch counters who were right across the counter from them. And one of the ways in which they could win was just to persuade them to change their policy. Right. So you have lots of different targets available. And in many cases, the protesters actually were able to persuade these lunch counter operators to change their policies. Most of the times they were most of the time, the lunch counter operators were less willing to do so. And then the question is, well, what is the role of the law here in terms of creating the options that they can and can't do? The lunch counter operators, they had the ability when the protesters came in to activate the law against the protesters, meaning that they could call the police and say, there are people in my restaurant who I don't want here. And then they could enforce a trespassing law against them, saying that they're trespassing on my property. Now, eventually, it'd be an interesting question about whether, in fact, that was racially discriminatory to use trespassing law against them. And that's something the courts would eventually pick up. But they clearly knew that they had that option, and they, you know, suspected that they could that would be allowable in court. But then the question is, did they actually want to do that? In many cases, not necessarily. Some of these people, you know, they're all segregationists of a sort, but they had different commitments to segregation. Some of them were more opportunistic segregationists, meaning that they segregated their lunch counters because they believed that's what their predominantly white clientele wanted. Some of them were more true believers in principles of segregation. So you have variations in terms of how deep their commitment was. But also, they're business people, and most of these lunch counters actually had some significant portion of their revenue, which was from African-American customers. And most of them could look around and realize the direction in which history was moving. And they could probably assume that these people who they're denying service today, at some point in the not too distant future, they're probably going to be required to serve them. And they weren't quite sure they necessarily wanted to be throwing potential paying customers in jail. It just wasn't necessarily a very good business policy. So most of the lunch counter owners, particularly in the Upper South, were quite ambivalent about this. Now, other people who can be classified within this broad category of segregationists were not quite so ambivalent. So we have the police. The police would show up at these lunch counter protests, and the police generally want to maintain law and order. And these protests oftentimes were quite combustible situations. So in some situations, they would be fine taking these people off to jail and trying to shut down these protests. But of course, at the time, unless the lunch counter owner said, I want to press trespassing charges, the police generally couldn't do anything. And if the protests were orderly, they would have trouble declaring that there's some sort of disorderly conduct taking place, although sometimes they would do that as well. But generally,
the passage from your book that stands out is when you describe, I think it was the initial Greensboro protest, when the officer shows up and one of the protesters describes how he was basically pacing behind them back and forth. He had his club in his hand, but it was like he was impotent. He couldn't actually follow through. The best he could do is just leer at them and ultimately, and at that point, that was the limit of his action.
It's the perfect image, right? So the police officer has incentive but not a power at that point. The bunch cutter proprietor is the one who has the power but less incentive, right? And they're kind of looking at each other. If you look at the cover of my book, I was able to find this picture, which I was just so excited when I found it, in which you have the protesters in the middle of the picture. You have the police officer looking down behind them, and then you have the lunch counter operator standing there looking at the protesters. And it's kind of a standoff. And one of the points of the book is to say, well, why was this standoff oftentimes the situation? A lot of it has to do with the legal issues there. And then I also pan back in the chapter and I look at, it's not just the police officers and the proprietors, but also politicians. Right, we know these Southern politicians, particularly on the state level, the governors, were mostly elected on strong segregationist platforms. Now, when it came to denouncing Brown versus Board of Education, school desegregation, what they could do, these state level segregationist politicians, they would consolidate authority, and they were able to create a movement of massive resistance against school desegregation because they were able to consolidate authority around by the state level and then make a strong stand, in which they had incentives and power to make a stand against school desegregation, against Brown versus Board of Education. Now, move forward to the sit-ins. The state-level politicians kept asking, I have these wonderful letters from the governor of North Carolina to the operator of the Greensboro Woolworths, in which these first protests took place, in which he's basically, begging him, like, start throwing these kids in jail. We got to clean this up. And the owner of the Woolworths is trying to explain, well, I don't really want to throw them in jail, right? He's just trying to sort of say, look at my situation. Is this really best for me? So again, you have this disconnect, just like with the police. You have the same thing with the Southern politicians, in which they have all sorts of incentive to show themselves as cracking down on this lawless integrationist movement. But yet they didn't really have the authority to do so. They couldn't just order the police officers to arrest all these students. In the Deep South, sometimes they did that. But generally in the Upper South, the governor was kind of reduced to the same position of the police officer. The governor was just writing these letters saying, we really should be arresting these students. I urge you to arrest these students. But this is why the sit-ins just turned out differently. You didn't have a strong uniform crackdown against the sit-ins. You had some sporadic crackdowns in certain locations. You had certainly some private violence against the sit-in protesters. That was all there. And you did have some proprietors who were interested in pressing charges. And then, again, you did have students numbering somewhere in the thousands who were eventually arrested. But this is of some 50,000 people who took part overall. So the protests, again, this is one of the powerful things about the protests. The vast majority of the protests continued on. They were not shut down by Southern law enforcement. But enough of them were thrown in jail, and enough of the cases did get into court that you were given something for the lawyers to work with, and you're also given this very powerful platform. When students started to get thrown in jail, it did extend their message in these really powerful ways. But this is a fascinating part of the sit-ins, which really hadn't been written up in the historiography of the sit-ins, because this is really some rather intricate legal doctrine that's lurking in the background that helps explain why the sit-ins turned out as they did. Again, we could tell much of the story of the sit-ins without focusing on these legal issues, but once you start bringing the legal issues from the background to the foreground, it really helps give us a lot more explanation about why the protest turned out as it did.
Let's turn to those legal issues, because you move from talking about the protests and the response to them to how the courts, in particular the Supreme Court, dealt with them. How was it that ultimately the Supreme Court came to hear these cases? What sort of cases were they hearing? And what were the positions of the justices on these various issues?
Yeah, so I dedicate a whole chapter to the Supreme Court, a chapter called The Justices, where I try and capture their perspective on the sit-in. And what I basically conclude is that the sit-in cases, and there's a series of cases that come out of the sit-in protest. Beginning in 1961, the Supreme Court hears some of the first cases involving the sit-ins. And every term at Supreme Court between 1961 and 1964, they hear more rounds of these sit-in cases. And they actually have a lot of trouble dealing with them. And what I concluded is that sit-ins, I call them one of the great aberrations of the Warren Court. So we think of the Warren Court, the court under Chief Justice Earl Warren, which really sort of announced his presence with the Brown versus Board of Education decision back in 1954. The Warren Court is recalled by history, largely correctly, as being a court which went out of its way to align itself with the cause of the civil rights movement, oftentimes creating new legal doctrine in ways to try to support the cause of racial justice during this period. But in the sit-in cases, they didn't quite do this. And in the sit-in cases, the Supreme Court never, even though they had these cases term after term, never squarely said that it's a violation of the Constitution to have racial segregation in these lunch counters. Never squarely said that Southern states couldn't use the police to enforce a racially neutral trespassing statute against sit-in protesters. Meaning, if you look at a trespassing statute, it doesn't say anything about race. It just is a trespassing statute that can be used in an ostensibly racial neutral manner. And the court never said that these people couldn't get thrown in jail if the lunch counter owners believed that they didn't want to serve them, even if it was because of their race. They weren't ever able to sort of come to that position, which the NAACP lawyers were urging them to do from 1960 onwards. So it's an aberration. So what I try and do this chapter is try and figure out, well, why did the Warren Court break pattern in this particular line of cases? Right? They made new law for Brown versus Board of Education. They made new law in the First Amendment with a lot of the civil rights issues and some other equal protection issues. They made new law. But in these cases, they didn't. And the reasons I eventually conclude that held the court back, some of it has to do with that doctrine I was talking about before. The state action doctrine is a difficult area of law. And a lot of justices have some concerns that even if they were willing to extend or modify the way the state action limitation works, such that maybe the Equal Protection Clause could capture the kind of activity that's taking place in sit-in protests, they're concerned about, well, what is the principle that would differentiate that from other areas where maybe it shouldn't extend that far? So they just had – these are just typical lawyer-judge kind of concerns about the scope of legal change and how legal doctrine operates. Some of it had to do with institutional concerns. So the justices were quite concerned about the fact that they weren't quite sure that courts were the best institutions to draw some of the lines that would need to be drawn between what is constitutional, what is unconstitutional forms of racial discrimination in this particular area. So much of it was self-consciousness about, wouldn't it just be better if legislatures dealt with this? Then a whole other component of, I think, their resistance to really embracing the student's claim, at least as a matter for the judges, had a lot to do with some of the judges, justices in the Supreme Court, were simply wary of direct action protests as an alternative to litigation. And Justice Hugo Black, who in many of the cases of the Warren Court era was really leading the charge, pushing strong equal protection readings, pushing strong free speech readings, he was, throughout much of the sit-in cases, he was adamantly against the position of the student protesters. And a lot has had to do with he just didn't like protests. He thought protests were sort of going to set the stage for a larger disorder. He thought that even if one protest looks like a good thing, it's going to get flipped around, it's going to go too far, the other side is going to start using protests. And he just had a certain sense that legal change should come not by demands from the streets, but should come through an orderly process of litigation. And he really just didn't like what these students were doing. And this is so one of the goals of this chapter is identify what I see as something of an irony, that the very elements that made a protest so powerful as acts of protest, which was really the sacrifice and the heroism and the strong confrontational element of the protest in the streets. This is what captured people's imagination. This is what got them into the front pages of national newspapers. This very thing that made them powerful as protests ultimately undermined their potential within the Supreme Court, because some of these justices just didn't like the idea of protests as being a vehicle for creating legal change.
As you mentioned, the justices were approached this with the attitude that it was better for the legislature to address this, and ultimately the legislative branch did. What does Congress ultimately do in response to the issues of the sit-ins that effectively addresses these issues, and what do they leave unaddressed?
Yeah, so this is the final chapter of the book turns from the courts to the legislature. And specifically, I look at the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which includes a provision called Title II, in which it effectively outlaws, as a matter of federal law, racial discrimination in restaurants, hotels, and lunch counters. So eventually, the great victory, at least as a matter of law, for the sit-in protests, it didn't take place in the courts, but it took place in Congress through the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The 1964 Civil Rights Act largely does resolve this issue in that most public accommodations are going to be covered by this particular law. So all the lunch counters that were targeted by the sit-in protests, they will, after 1964, be required to have non-discriminatory service. But it is interesting, if you look at the details of how it was, the law was written, there were some minor carve-outs. For example, when applied to hotels, it did have carve-outs for certain people who ran lodging accommodations in which they were quite small, and if they lived in the same accommodation in which they were renting out, they could actually be exempted from the law. And this was called the Mrs. Murphy exemption, the idea being that certain people have some sort of privacy interest and that they don't necessarily need to be should not be regulated by this particular law. So it's a pretty comprehensive law, but there are some small details that do create some carve-outs. And what I try to say in this chapter is that these carve-outs were in part a concession to an argument that was made by a lot of the opponents of the sit-in movements, in which they were trying to say that even if you accept that there's an equality principle that's pushing for non-discrimination, they said that it should be balanced against a privacy interest or an associational interest on the part of business operators. And I think that argument was largely pushed aside, but it did actually have some resonance, and it does show up on the margins of some of the legal change that happened. And I should just say that if you're just trying to connect some of the story from the early 1960s up to the present day, of course, we're still debating this. We're still debating whether there's some sort of privacy or liberty interest that can, in some ways, limit the scope of anti-discrimination policy. And the Supreme Court just last week issued a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, in which it recognized that there could be potentially some First Amendment limits to the application of anti-discrimination law. And this had to do with a baker making a cake for a same-sex wedding ceremony. So these issues were quite prominent in the story that I tell in the early 1960s, but they do replay over and over again. Anytime you have an attempt to spread an anti-discrimination norm through law further into society, you get these pushbacks in which people start questioning, are there other principles at stake here? So I am able to sort of describe a earlier story which foreshadows some of the debates that we're still having today.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, so my new project is partially a spinoff project from this one, and it's a history of civil rights from the Reconstruction era up to today. And I have to say, I know that sounds like a hugely broad topic, but the way I'm bringing this down to size is my focus is on civil rights as a term, as a label, and how that phrase has been used in different ways throughout American history. So civil rights first emerged as a discrete topic or matter of law in the 1860s, right after the Civil War, when the Reconstruction Congress is passing laws. We have the first federal civil rights laws passed in 1866. It's part of the discussion over the 14th Amendment. And then I trace how the concept of what is and what is not a civil right, how it flows from the 1860s up into the 20th century, briefly stopping with the sit-ins because I was fascinated by a lot of the student sit-in protesters who actually said what we're doing is not civil rights, which is just an interesting statement, you know, considering that the sit-in movement is one of the iconic moments of what we consider the civil rights movement. some of them at the time actually said, no, we're not doing civil rights. Civil rights is what the lawyers do. We're doing something else. And they had different names for what they were doing. And then I trace it up to today, where we have a lot of debate today over what is a valid civil rights claim and whether conservatives have the right to stake out civil rights claims that are all different from the kind of claims that liberals embrace. So it's a very different project. It's a sit-in book, was a very sort of narrow focus on 4 or 5 years in the 1960s. The second project is taking several steps back and trying to see how a particular concept unfolds over time and in all different number of different circumstances.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting project.
We'll see.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for taking some of your time to speak with us today. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.